All right, if not, as I said earlier, we'll move on to the second paper. This one I think you may find interesting. It talks about crew tasks and training. Usually we let the launch vehicle loft us, but this morning we're going to use our own little Joe. Just make one other observation as he's going up. There's a peculiar inversion in the manned spaceflight program in which people with psychological training are considered to be the peculiar ones. And there are a few of them that have come through the crucible, Bill Lee and Joe, and I think Star Draper started out as a psychologist, if I remember correctly. And they have turned into useful citizens. So you'll notice that we'll get a few well-couched remarks from Mr. Loftus.
That's a very hard routine to follow. I can't speak for others, but at this point in the symposium, I feel a little bit like the man who asked for a drink and got doused with a high-pressure fire hose. This paper, I think, will be somewhat different in that we are concerned with crew activity, which lends itself perhaps more to a qualitative dimension than to the kind of quantitative summaries you've been seeing. My objective will be to provide a qualitative appreciation of the crew activities, not too much detail on any specific point, because generally it is misleading if taken out of context, and because it is highly undesirable to read a large phone book to an audience this size. We will also discuss the training facilities, not only in their customary role as training devices, but as development tools for operating procedures and strategies. We begin with the requirements placed upon the crew. They participate as the abort initiation system in many parts of the launch. There are automatic aborts in the early phase of the launch vehicle where failures can be beyond the time constant suitable for crew action. A great number of the aborts, however, can be better detected by the crew on board the vehicle because of their capacity to participate as a direct sensor through the appreciation of motion, vibration, and noise. In addition, the ground can observe some failures which the crew might not perceive so readily and can request abort action. In the flight control regime, the crew functions in the sense of a programmer, selecting the modes of the system and acts as a sensor in certain modes, in the landing and in the docking, and is a control element in the manual control loop. Subsystem management allows wide ranges of variation in the use of the consumables, in the navigation activities. The crew serves as both a control element and as a sensing element in the use of the guidance optics. The onboard mission management functions are primarily those where time is critical, where the crew, by virtue of its presence in the vehicle, has better data, and during those time periods in the mission when it is out of communications with the ground complex. The crew structure is an authority structure, with duties being primarily a function of station rather than direct assignment to an individual. For this reason, the crew is completely cross-trained, and it is trained as a team in the interests of enhancing reliability and to maximize the capacity of the crew to accept high workloads, certain portions of the mission. The types of training are essentially those with which we are familiar. Systems training consisting of briefings, textual materials, and actual participation in a number of spacecraft tests and engineering reviews. There are a number of specific task training elements related largely to particular manual skills, such as docking, extravehicular activities, landing, and other activities of this character. Mission segment training is that type of training which is defined by the mission phase. Characteristic of this type are rendezvous, transposition docking, and entry. Specific mission training relates to those things which are determined by the trajectories and objectives of a particular mission. Illustrative of this class might be the lunar landmark briefings which would precede a particular mission to a particular site. Finally, there is experimental activity training, which is mission-specific also. In such cases as the Lunar Surface Experiments Package, but includes a large amount of general background training in such subjects as geology. The elements of crew training are the normal modes of crew activity, which occupies perhaps the smallest portion of the total training time. Training in malfunction recognition and response, which due to the nature of the system is a complex problem. Emergency mode crew activity probably occupies the largest single proportion of crew time in training because of the requirement for both prompt action and for high reliability. Again, we have some emphasis upon the training of the crew as a team, not only amongst themselves, but in a number of exercises in conjunction with the flight controllers. This is a brief summary listing of the major subsystem classes with which the crew and the training deal. There is some cross-summarization between the command module, the launch vehicle, and the lunar module in this listing. The last one is perhaps one often overlooked, and that is the extravehicular mobility unit, since there is a significant amount of training involved in the efficient use of this complex. The training facilities represent rather a large array of equipments. This is due primarily to the dimensions of the problem, to the limits of particular devices, and to the requirement to be able to concurrently train several crews. The systems trainers are animated schematics of particular spacecraft systems, wherein the system is laid out in these panels. The spacecraft controls and displays related to these subsystems are shown on this panel, and there is a panel wherein malfunctions and anomalies can be created in the system so that the character of the malfunction and the symptoms associated can be studied. We have mock-ups of both of the vehicles involved, the command module and the lunar module. These devices are used for training in the many stowage and housekeeping functions, extravehicular activity, and other geometry-defined activities. The dynamic crew procedures trainer, currently in the Gemini configuration, can accept a command module configuration. This device is used to provide the dynamic environment associated with various launch conditions and entry conditions. It's primarily devoted to abort training. It provides sound, motion, and visual cues suitable for this environment, since these are a significant part of the development of crew responses for such emergency conditions. This device can also accept a lunar module configuration for training in the dynamics of the lunar module motion, in landing, and in ascent. The transposition and docking trainer, here shown in the Gemini configuration, can be configured with the LEM or the command module as the active element in the docking configuration. The lunar landing research vehicle shown here is illustrative of the lunar landing training vehicle, which can provide a flight environment simulation for the terminal portions of the LEM landing. We will discuss this device more at a later time. The egress trainer is used for training the crew in the post-landing and recovery phases of the mission and integration of their activities with the recovery forces. The Apollo Mission Simulator and the Lunar Mission Simulator, Lunar Module Mission Simulator, is to follow, represent the major complexes in the training array. The computer assembly is shown in the back room here. There is a model house for the generation of the docking images, an instructor's console where the device can be programmed and malfunctions can be inserted. The command module is nested among this large array of infinity image optical systems, which are reflective viewing systems for providing the images to the windows of the vehicle. This particular assembly provides the images to the guidance optics. The magnitude of this device can perhaps be appreciated. It is a 128-word memory system with four central processors in parallel. The processors have 2.5 microsecond add times, effectively giving a nanosecond computer capability. There is a fully buffered channel capacity of 1 million words per second. The lunar mission simulator is only slightly smaller. The computer complex is three computers with a 98,000-word memory capacity. It has a image generation system for the command module docking portion of the mission and for the lunar touchdown portion of the mission. Film provides the approach configuration, again through the Infinity Image window systems. The window on the right side is shown here. The left window is shadowed in order that you can see the configuration of the crew and the vehicle. There is also an image system for presentation to the overhead window, which is used for observation of the horizon during powered descent and through which the rendezvous docking is made in the ascent portion of the mission. These two devices can be operated in an integrated mode and can be integrated with the Mission Control Center to provide complete operational rehearsals of the mission. In addition to these devices, which are primarily oriented to the training and operational rehearsals, we have certain engineering devices which are used for special functions and tests, as well as for certain specific types of training. The centrifuge shown here accepts a fixture which has the three couches and all of the controls and displays suitable for launch, entry, and other high acceleration portions of the mission. There is a KC-135 aircraft of the Air Force, which is used to simulate 0G and 1/6G periods, again, primarily for development testing, but also for certain selected types of training, primarily associated with extravehicular activities and with certain types of docking activity. Representative of another large class of such devices is the Lunar Landing Research Facility shown here, which, again, is primarily a development device, but which can be used for training in certain selected portions of the mission. In addition to the devices shown, we have a large number of engineering simulation facilities at the contractors at North American, Grumman, MIT. The mission for which these devices are used to prepare the crew involves a number of significant phases. We have here a typical profile of a mission showing two of the major constraints with which we must flight plan. The control events, shown as black diamonds, are such things as the launch, transposition and docking, translunar injection, and activities of this variety. The dark bars show the sleep periods, which are allocated to the crew. The initial sleep period is obviously dictated by the time of the crew's waking in preparation for the launch, and we must then schedule these activities so that we arrive in the lunar orbit insertion and lunar descent portion of the mission suitably refreshed to enter a period of rather high density activity, the last mid-course correction, the lunar orbit insertion, and then the series of activities leading up to and including the lunar landing. The profile shown here reflects a constraint that we shall not exceed 16 to 18 hours between periods of crew rest. It also presumes that we shall sleep three crewmen at the same time, this being based upon the capacity of the ground in this mission to at all times view the vehicle, which and to wake the crew in the event that they observe some anomaly. In the lunar portion of the mission, we schedule an exploration period, which includes some engineering activities in its early part, immediately after the landing. The logic which dictates this schedule is that the portable life support systems are at this time fully charged, and the vehicle is pressurized. If we perform an exploration at this time, we can have an exterior check of the vehicle in the time period immediately after landing. We can do the donning of the PLSS and the thermal meteorite garments in a pressurized cabin, depressurize the cabin, perform the exterior activities, return, pressurize the cabin, and then doff this gear and recharge it in a pressurized configuration. If we had chosen to sleep first, which we can do in real time, we would, in order to have back-to-back exploration periods, require recharging of the PLSS in a evacuated ascent stage. This can be accomplished. There are procedures for so doing, but in the early missions, it seemed desirable to have the additional benefit of the pressurized cabin. This also allows us to have a suitable period of rest prior to the activities of ascent into lunar orbit and trans-Earth injection. The slides on the right screen summarize the proportions of mission time, a total of 216 hours, and the proportions of the total crew man hours, 648, which are devoted to various types of specific activity. The control tasks, as one would expect, occupy a relatively small proportion of the total mission time, though they are obviously the most critical events. The relative proportions devoted to such activities are obviously a function of the particular details of a mission, though one may expect certain proportional relationships to remain constant for all missions. You notice that in such activities as monitoring, which is done primarily by a man who would be on a watch configuration, we have some accumulation of potential crew time as opposed to mission time. This can be more apparent than real. This slide illustrates another group of the activities which are assigned to the crew. A number of them require activity by all three crewmen. Some are performed primarily by one man at a given time. This particular list of activities concerns itself with things that are primarily mechanical manipulations, the changing of stations within the vehicle, the donning and doffing of the suit, the manipulation of the docking equipments, and things of this nature. The exploration period, effectively the payload, represents 2% approximately of the total mission time and of the total crew man hours. A third of the mission time and crew man hours are devoted to sleep. And in this particular summary, it indicates that we have 31% of the mission hours or 46% of the crew man hours which are not scheduled. The validity of such a number is, of course, only as good as our analysis of the times required to perform particular functions and is highly sensitive to the details of particular flight planning. It would naturally be expected that at least some portion of this time would be used in some experiments. This particular slide illustrates the available volume of the vehicles. The geometry of the command module is, of course, dictated primarily by the entry requirement and the offset center of mass through the heavy equipments, and by the sweep volume required for the couch in land landings. The crew compartment volume is defined as the lightly shaded area, and the effective free volume is that area not occupied by such objects as the couch, the portable life support system, and the various other stowed equipments. The lunar module geometry is defined by the requirement to counterbalance the loads around the ascent engine. And again, we have a reduction in the total pressurized volume by the various equipments. Comparable figures for the Gemini vehicle are 80 cubic feet of pressurized volume and 50 cubic feet of effective free volume. We do expect that the larger volume and the somewhat more favorable geometry will enhance the effectiveness of a number of types of crew activity. The command module main display console, shown here, is color-coded to indicate the various proportions of functional activities allocated display space. It is somewhat difficult to appreciate since there are large numbers of time-shared displays. It is significant, however, to note the relatively large proportions devoted to the sustaining systems, since this vehicle must accomplish the long-time elements of the mission. There are a number of levels of redundancy and cross-switching available within the environmental and the electrical power generation and distribution systems. At this point, it would be well to review the configuration of the vehicle at each of the phases of the mission and to examine the crew functions which characterize that phase of the mission. During launch, the crew is primarily concerned with monitoring the characteristics of the launch vehicle and its flight performance, maintaining communication, and monitoring the condition of the spacecraft. The duties are generally assigned to the command pilot on the left, the senior pilot in the center, and the pilot on the right. This is consistent with the arrangement of the main display console shown previously. The arrangement of the vehicle at this time has a number of soft goods stowed on the floor. The permanent installation of the lithium hydroxide canisters used in the ECS, and a large number of equipment stowed on the upper wall and in a number of compartments on both sides of the vehicle. The crew is not shown in the launch configuration because they would obstruct the view of everything else, but they are beneath the array of harnesses, oxygen umbilicals, and communications lines. It is difficult to describe, in a sense that can be appreciated, the monitoring activity in launch. We have a film of some abort procedures studies conducted 2 years ago, which will show the type of facility upon which the Dynamic Crew Procedures Trainer was based and which is used for training at this time. In this configuration, we have a Saturn I. In this particular case, we can see the roll index at the time of the roll maneuver on the launch vehicle. The digital event timer is counting. It's at 14 seconds now. At 40 seconds, there will be a loss of the vehicle pitch control loop. You will note that we begin to see pitch rates and that a pitch error begins to develop. The vibration apparent is a function of the motion of the simulator. Once an abort decision is taken, either as in the case illustrated by the crew or on ground request, the abort light would appear if we had a ground request, or if an automatic abort had been taken, or when the crew commanded the abort by twisting the translational hand controller to a hard stop counterclockwise. The crew then has the capability to monitor a large number of the events which take place automatically. The timer would reset so that the time sequence characteristic of the abort can be monitored. There is the capability to note the acceleration of the launch escape motor. If this does not occur, the event can be commanded by the crew. Those items shown with question marks are effectively items checked to confirm the functioning of an automatic sequencer, confirming that the command module reaction control system has pressurized, confirms that the relays have thrown, which cut the tension ties, dead-face the command module and service module, and arm the command module batteries to provide electrical power in that configuration and pressurize the command module RCS for attitude control. 11 seconds after the initiation of the abort, the canards would be deployed. If they do not, the crew can command that event through an independent path. Again, it can confirm that the Earth landing system logic has been armed and provide an alternate path for the jettison of the launch escape tower. Drogue chute deployment can be confirmed below 24,000 feet. The crew has a barometric altimeter, and in the event that that does not occur, they can again provide a redundant path. Again, they monitor the deployment of the main chutes, and if they do not occur, they again have an alternate path. Once on the main parachutes, no longer requiring the attitude control of the command module RCS system, they would close the cabin pressure relief valves through a lever mounted on this panel, command the necessary dumping and purging of the command module RCS, reopen the valves, which had been closed to prevent ingestion of the gases, and after landing, which seems like the suitable place, release the main chutes. The characteristic of the abort after 61 seconds is just that there is not an automatic dumping of the RCS propellants, because above that point in time, one may require the use of the attitude control system. In the Earth orbit phase of the mission, the crew has control of the total space vehicle, including the Saturn, the S4, through the interface between the spacecraft guidance computer and the launch vehicle guidance computer. After Earth orbit insertion, the crew would realign the inertial measurement unit using the guidance optics, and provided there were time, as one would have if one were going to make the translunar injection on the second orbit, they can provide certain navigation activities in Earth orbit. These would probably be done to confirm the condition of the system, since the navigation capabilities in the ground track stations would provide the primary navigation. The technique used for orbital navigation is, however, also used in lunar orbit, where we have a known orbital condition to assess the altitude of landing sites. The film shows the procedure used by the crew in viewing through the scanning telescope in Earth orbit because of the relatively high rotational rates. The primary point will be placed upon the delta at the river mouth, and as the point is tracked beneath the vehicle and out of the plane of the vehicle, the rotation of the reticle is the rotation about the shaft axis as we track in the trunnion axis. This technique will be used again in lunar orbit, where the scanning telescope can be used because of the lower orbital rates. Prior to translunar injection, the crew would fine align the inertial measurement unit and begin the countdown for the ignition of the second burn of the S4B. they have the capability to inhibit this command should their onboard data indicate that the vehicle is not ready for the mission. There is, however, only a single opportunity due to the requirements in the countdown. During this burn, as during all other propulsive maneuvers, the crew will have prepared the vehicle for peak power loads by bringing both batteries and fuel cells on the line, be monitoring the condition of the various systems, and in particular monitor the guidance performance. Perhaps of some interest is that during this burn, we see the first of a number of very low acceleration environments, this being approximately 1 1/3 G during this time. Transposition and docking becomes the first of a number of activities in which the crew provides the primary mode of activity. Immediately after the conclusion of the translunar injection burn, the crew would initiate a roll and pitch maneuver with the total space vehicle to place the high-gain antenna for the S-4B in proper configuration to illuminate the manned spaceflight network stations on the Earth and to provide optimum lighting for the docking maneuver to follow. This maneuver takes approximately 5 minutes due to the relatively low rates of maneuver used with this high mass configuration. It takes approximately 10 minutes for the ground stations to confirm the adequacy of the orbit to which we have been injected. And subsequent to this point in time, the crew is free to proceed with the maneuvers of separating the command module to a distance of approximately 100 feet. Again, they enter a roll and pitch maneuver to provide antenna orientation for the command and service module to the ground stations and begin the sequence of activities leading up to the docking. This particular slide shows the fashion in which the couches are moved about these pivot points and along a rack in order to provide an optimum view for the crew through the rendezvous and docking window, which can be used by the crewmen on the left and on the right. The view available to the pilot performing the maneuver is illustrated in this slide, and the characteristics of this maneuver are seen in this film. We have suspended a full-scale model of the lunar module, and we are approaching it with a pilot-manipulated command module, where all of the dynamics of the situation have been reflected into the motion of that unit. The red device is the docking target, which is observed by the command module pilot through an optical device much like a gun sight. The white cross stands 14 inches above the red target. It is T-shaped with a diamond in the center of the intersection of the bars. As long as that diamond remains within the white circle, the docking is being performed within the capture range of the probe and drogue. The vertical standoff gives the pilot some cue as to his errors out of the line of approach. The lines of the T are an index of the proper rotational indexing and roll of the command module and the lunar module. This is a reasonably exact representation of the view available to the crew at the point where the docking is achieved. After having made the initial contact with the probe and drogue, the probe mechanism provides for retraction of the lunar module to the command module and the setting of four latches, at which time a soft docking is achieved. A sequence of activities is begun to pressurize the tunnel area against a leak rate. A pressure hatch in this plane and a thermal hatch in this plane are removed by the crew. Eight additional latches are handset by the crew to achieve a hard dock and structural integrity. And redundant umbilicals are connected to the lunar module to provide for the electrical current required in the lunar module during the translunar leg of the mission and to provide a path for the pyrotechnic device actuations which will release the lunar module from the adapter. After this operation has been performed, the docking mechanisms are restored in the tunnel, and the crew activates the pyrotechnic device and withdraws the lunar module from the adapter by using the service module reaction control system in a minus X translation mode. This is done using a series of short intermittent burns to preclude the amount of impingement of the service module RCS upon the thermal coatings of the lunar module. They establish a separation rate of approximately 3 feet per second and then orient the vehicle for passive thermal control during the remainder of the mission. Translunar coast is characterized primarily by the mid-course correction requirements, which are determined by the precision of the initial guidance, by the necessity to monitor and maintain periodic checks on the systems to establish and maintain the how goes it lines, periodic maintenance of systems such as the fuel cells and the ECS, and a number of the general housekeeping and crew activities necessary to living during the period while we go to the moon. This seems a suitable point to discuss the housekeeping problem. The slide on the right shows the various stowage compartments in the three walls of the vehicle, the lower equipment bay, the right-hand equipment bay, and the left-hand equipment bay, and on the rearward side of the main display console. There are a large number of items stowed in each of these compartments, the numbers being indicated here. This is a small volume in which three men must live for a protracted period, and it becomes the type of situation in which everything must have its place and predominantly be in that place. I think the numbers are reasonably impressive all by themselves, and while obviously subject to a good deal of discussion in terms of what would be defined as an operation or what one should define as a unit, it does signify that there is a significant problem in simply keeping track of the location and usage of each of the devices. This is one of the things which contributes to the requirement for a good deal of formality and care in various procedures. This slide illustrates the configuration of the vehicle during those periods when the crew would sleep in the command module. Two of the crewmen sleep under the couches in sleeping bag arrangements, which provide some measure of thermal control and which further allow the crew to be restrained in the zero-G environment. The third man sleeps in his couch, where he has direct access to the environmental and electrical control systems which sustain the vehicle. Should any anomaly develop, the crew can be awakened in the command module by a direct up data link command. At this time, the suits would be stowed in bags. The helmets are shown here, and the remaining two suits would be stowed in the couches at this particular point in time. This slide illustrates the arrangements for the preparation of food. Food is stowed in this compartment in man meal type containers. There is a water delivery probe in this vicinity. The system has the capability for providing three meals at the same time to the crew. There is a work shelf provided at this point in the vehicle so that equipment can be manipulated in the environment. This slide illustrates the arrangements of the mechanical components of the environmental control system, which allow the crew to have access to the lithium hydroxide canister installed in the system. There are two canisters in parallel. Each has a 24-hour life, and they are cycled so that there is a cylinder change each 12 hours. In addition to providing the removal of carbon dioxide, these cylinders also contain an amount of carbon to minimize the accumulation of unpleasant odors. That problem, however, is relieved primarily by venting such odors directly overboard. Typical of the types of status checks which may be conducted during this portion of the mission is an ECS periodic review, wherein those parameters characterizing the nominal performance of the vehicle can be examined. A number of these are displayed continuously, such as the glycol steam pressure, the glycol discharge pressure. In the event that we are in the suits, it is possible to notice the delta P and the oxygen flow at this point in time. Some of the displays are time shared. This particular switch controls the display of primary potable water versus wastewater quantities in those tanks. The radiator outlet temperature is an index of the adequacy of the passive thermal control activity. Glycol temperature indicates the condition of the electronics cooling, and then we can confirm the general comfort levels of the cabin at this particular point, and we have the partial pressure of CO2 as an indication of the safety of the atmosphere. Any event which is critical to the safety of the crew is wired into the logic of the caution and warning system, where we have an array of events here which can direct their attention should something occur that is not immediately perceived in the monitoring of the systems. Navigation activities can also be performed on the translunar and transearth portions of the mission. The geometry of this activity was described earlier by Dr. Duncan. We have a film which shows the scenes which are perceived by the crew as they use the scanning telescope initially to orient the vehicle to the Earth. You can see the line shaft axis of the scanning telescope with a 25-degree offset circle being placed upon the Earth. This allows a larger field of view to acquire a star. The star is here. You can see that the shaft axis is being rotated to bring the star and the Earth into the same plane. When this condition has been established and stabilized, you can see the line now across the star, we can transfer the eye to the sextant, a 28-power optical device. Here we see that a vehicle rate is moving the scene across the face of the Earth. in the fixed line of sight, and this is recovered. We now have the star being placed on the Sierra Maestra Peninsula in Cuba. The star is fixed on the landmark, and a mark can be made at that time for the entrance of navigational data to the computer. That view is approximately from 25,000 miles. In the early missions, we contemplate checking out the lunar module prior to lunar orbit entry in order to have the benefit of its systems for certain abort contingencies, and also to confirm the health of the vehicle prior to the commitment to lunar orbit insertion. This has some additional advantage in that it allows the complete sequence of activity to be observed by the ground. In order to perform this activity, the crew must enter the lunar module, and since it has depressurized most probably during this interval, there is a procedure whereby we pressurize the tunnel area and the lunar module from the command module, and then having confirmed that the pressure is equivalent across the tunnel and in the vehicles, we can remove the pressure hatch, the ablative hatch, the probe, and the drogue, and then open the lunar module hatch and enter into the lunar module. It would be expected that two of the crewmen would enter the lunar module to conduct the checkout. The logic which leads to such an approach can be appreciated if one observes the complexity of the activity associated in doing this. This slide shows the configuration of the vehicle during the stowage of the pressure and ablative hatches in the command module, the drogue, and the probe. And this crewman, his foot is seen here, is beginning the transfer. A film showing the dynamics of this action. I think finally we have the film. This is the removal of the pressure hatch being done in the zero-G aircraft. At this time, we did not have stowable optics. This shows why it was desirable. As you can see, the manipulation of the hatch and the constraints of the command module is somewhat difficult. With the optics removed, it is substantially easier. In this case, we have been using a tool to relieve some of the loads in the probe. And the next sequence will show the removal of the probe. Since we can now view from the other end of the tunnel, we can appreciate the manipulation a little more exactly. It should be appreciated that these activities are conducted in 30-second increments as allowed by the facility, which is an aircraft in flight. And finally, we see the transfer of the crewmen on the command module umbilicals into the lunar module and the orientation through which he turns around. The lunar module control panel is significantly devoted to flight control activities, many of its sustaining activities being automatic because of the large portion of the time devoted to the flight regimes of the mission and to the desire to have the vehicle self-sustaining so that the crew can explore concurrently. This is also, to some degree, a reflection of the somewhat simpler sustaining systems, batteries for electrical power, and bottled gases rather than cryogenic stores for the life support system. The orientation of the panel within the vehicle can be better appreciated in this slide, where we have the circuit breaker panels and radar controls over here, the main display panel here, the alignment optical telescope in the center, some of the devices peculiar to this configuration are the sequence camera and the lunar module mounted in a fixed bracket here, parallel to the cruise line of sight, so that it can observe the lunar landing and record it. The TV camera is stowed here. There is stowage of much of the scientific equipment in these bays. Characteristic of the checkout sequence which might be conducted would be the confirmation of the regulators by confirming the talkbacks associated with the switch, an examination of the pressurization of the system by checking the descent pressurization's configuration of the indicator, helium pressure, and the other system status points, which you can read. This would be the sequence of activities up to the point where the crew would begin that sequence for the descent engine, which is associated with the throttle manipulation. Lunar orbit insertion is again a guidance maneuver which has been discussed in some significant detail prior to this point. The activities are very similar on the part of the crew at this for this maneuver as for the translunar injection and for the Earth orbit insertion. There is an aspect of the geometry which has not been commented upon. The graph on the right by a left-handed draftsman shows the growth in the apparent size of the moon as a function of mission time. The schematic on the left shows the effect of the lighting conditions. At this particular point in time, the moon occupies 23 degrees. An hour later, it is 63 degrees. And 15 minutes later, it has grown to approximately 130 degrees with 134 degrees apparent size in lunar orbit. The significant thing is that we will be approaching the dark of the moon, and the Earth shine is from a half-Earth. The crew can, however, perceive that this is not a collision course by observing the apparent regression of the limb of the moon against the line of sight. It shall nonetheless be a very dramatic moment. After entry into lunar orbit, we would again transfer into the lunar module and transfer a significant amount of equipment. The portable life support system has been carried in the command module because it provides a capability to transfer into the LEM should we have some difficulty in pressurizing it from the command module. This gives us the capability to transfer on a life support system so that we may be able to achieve some success. The EOS is the emergency oxygen supply, which provides a 5-minute capability in a high-pressure bottle and is used to provide an emergency backup to the portable life support system. These have been stowed in the command module in order to have them in a somewhat more favorable thermal environment. The EV gloves and the thermal meteoroid garment have been kept in the command module to provide for an extravehicular capability if required. There is but a single radiation survey meter, and it would now go to the lunar module since this is the more thin-skinned vehicle. Again, we have a single TV camera. The EVCT is the extravehicular crew transfer device. The umbilicals would remain in the command module. The series of maneuvers associated with the LEM descent to the lunar surface has been discussed in considerable detail by Mr. Jenkins and Mr. Cheatham. This is a very brief review of the activities assigned to the crew in conjunction with the primary guidance system and the abort guidance system. In addition to these, there are a number of pilotage activities which can be performed by the crew as opportunity allows through the overhead window, which is above the left crewman. It is possible during the descent phase of the mission to have a view of the lunar horizon, which may provide some useful indications of attitude and altitude. The primary function of the crew during the braking phase is to monitor the automatic systems and to provide suitable initiation of various equipments. They would confirm the status of the reaction control system and the ascent propulsion system prior to final approach in order to confirm the existence of their abort capability. It's interesting to note that during this portion of the mission, the crew will be seeing approximately one-third of a G, and of course the vector will be along their body axis as they would be standing. This film shows the Lunar Landing Research Vehicle, which has now flown approximately 140 flights, as it simulates a lunar landing. It takes off in a VTOL mode using the jet engine as its thrust source and being controlled by a hydrogen peroxide reaction control system. The pilot will climb to approximately 600 feet, turn around, and establish the initial conditions for the entry to the simulated portion of the LUM descent trajectory. He will establish these conditions at approximately 400 feet altitude, 45 feet per second forward velocity, and approximately 9 feet per second descent velocity at that point in time. At the top of his trajectory, we will have a view over the pilot's shoulder, which will show the direct relationship between the geometry of the controls and displays provided in this vehicle and that characteristic of the LEM. There are one or two departures from the fidelity of the simulation in that the line of sight of the seated crewman in this vehicle cannot be depressed so far as in the lunar module, and he is seated rather than standing. The seating requirement derives from the necessity of a ejection seat for safety purposes. Here you can notice the cross-range and downrange indicators, the flight director, the thrust-to-weight indicators. There is a three-axis hand controller for attitude, and the vehicle is configured as is the lamp. The geometry of viewing to the instruments and to the window is correct. When the pilot has established his initial conditions, he transfers to a lunar simulation mode in which the engine is gimbaled and provides 5/6 of a G. The steam plume, which you just saw, was the ignition of the simulated descent engine, also a hydrogen peroxide engine. From this point on, the attitudes are characteristic of the lunar module descent, and its piloting characteristics can be appreciated since the control authority is that of the lunar module. In this particular instance, the attitude is about 12 to 15 degrees back to reduce the horizontal velocities. He enters a hover at approximately 75 feet and begins a controlled rate of descent to the touchdown point, reducing the rate to approximately 3.5 feet until he is very near the surface, where a major departure in the simulation occurs, since this vehicle is flown in a thrust-to-touchdown mode. And that is a nice touch of nostalgia in the background. You can see the hand controller in this illustration, and you could see the engine gimbal to its null position. This graph is in the format used earlier to show the activities characteristic of the lunar stay time. Immediately after landing, we would check the vehicle to assure that we did not have any unacceptable conditions. We would vent the descent tanks in order to preclude problems due to thermal buildups. And we would immediately align our IMU and place it in a standby mode in order to have a anytime departure capability. The post-landing checkout is scheduled for 33 minutes, and this is based upon rehearsals, some of which we shall see shortly in a film. Again, this particular scheme shows the donning of the extravehicular equipments and an initial exploration activity during which such things as inspection of the vehicle for any apparent exterior damage or leaking to confirm the conditions of the landing, such as depressions in the lunar surface, slide marks, or things of this nature. In the early extravehicular activity, there would be such activities as the deployment of the necessary equipments, such as the antennas. There would be an initial survey from the lunar module platform to do TV and film scans of the area for later analysis. The next series of slides shows the configuration of the vehicle at various activities. In this particular case, we have the crewman donning the portable life support system. It shows one crewman in the thermal meteoroid garment with the portable life support system and with the emergency oxygen supply attached. The second portable life support system is shown here. This is the extravehicular crew transfer device. Food and other equipments are stowed here. As noted, one of the first extravehicular activities would be a camera survey of the area and a post-landing inspection. You can see the net and cable device used to transfer equipment to the surface from the ascent stage. This slide illustrates the sleeping arrangements within the vehicle. One of the crewmen suspends a hammock arrangement from the front edge of the ascent stage dome or ascent engine dome back to the rear wall, and the other crewman can sleep across the floor of the vehicle. We have a film which was made during engineering studies. Our object in showing it to you is to give some opportunity to appreciate the formality of the procedures that are required and some direct appreciation of the time required to accomplish particular functions. The suits shown are the test configuration of our Apollo suit for the lunar landing. We do not plan to provide the third crewman to help save the time. He's here merely as part of the data acquisition system. The camera through which we are observing has a counterpart above this window, and there is some distortion in a few of the scenes since this is a 140-degree field of view lens. Here we see the crewman releasing the restraint harness, which has helped to stabilize them in position during the attitude maneuvers and during the landing dynamics. Since the vehicle is pressurized at this time, and because it enhances the speed and efficiency of operations, the crew would be expected to remove their helmets and gloves while donning the extravehicular gear. These activities can be performed by a single individual, but they go much more rapidly and with considerably more confidence when you have two men who can perform an operation and check each other. Again, the complexity of the operation is one which makes it very formally a checklist operation. Here we see the portable life support system transferred from the command module and stowed temporarily on the floor of the vehicle, being mounted in the harness called the donning station, where it is suitably mounted adjacent to the checkout controls and where it can be held in place while the crewman dons the rest of the equipment which he requires. Here we see the thermal meteoroid garment trousers. We just did a fast 20 minutes to bring ourselves to this point in the checkout of the portable life support system and the donning of the equipment. We thread the carrying straps for the portable life support system through the thermal meteoroid jacket in this fashion, to minimize the difficulties of thermal shorts in the garment. The jacket is difficult to don, but it is a trade-off essentially between ease of donning and the later cumbersomeness of excessive material. You can appreciate some of the difficulties in this scene where one of the men is donning it. You can also appreciate the convenience and somewhat improvement in time required where two men perform the activity together. This is the coupling of the portable life support system connections to the suit so that these can be checked prior to dependence upon the system. And that's after a substantial amount of practice. Here we have stepped forward again, a substantial period in time, and we have the two crewmen in the garments, and you can appreciate now how crowded the compartment can get. Two men with the portable life support systems and the various other elements of the suit occupy a pretty substantial volume, and when pressurized, they move in a somewhat cumbersome fashion. It takes a great deal of time to perform a number of these operations because they are performed very, very carefully. There is obviously a substantial motivation. This assembly is the extravehicular visor, which provides various degrees of transmissibility. This sequence of activity shows the procedures for departure from the vehicle. The assembly stationed on the initial portion of the ladder is a A-frame type stepladder, which can also be opened out. This is provided to enhance the ease of access to various portions of the descent stage to contend with various orientations of the vehicle and to make easier the crew's access to the fixed ladder on the front leg. This shows the method of moving equipment such as the sample return containers from the ascent stage to the surface, and the distance is appreciable. It is not desirable to encumber the crewman to carry these items back and forth. One would have some decontamination process prior to entry, both to preclude damage to such things as the hatch seals and in order to reduce any debris brought back into the crew compartment. The net is used for those things which do not have ready attachment points in their own right. It is reasonably apparent from the nature of this activity that substantial amounts of time are required to perform activities that we normally conceive as being done rather expeditiously. This accounts to some degree for the fashion in which we schedule crew time and for the fact that it is not very difficult during the course of the mission to encounter conditions wherein things take substantially more time than were contemplated. The mere act of fastening a snap, which can be very straightforward in 1G and street clothes, can become a very demanding operation in a pressurized suit under weightless conditions, or even at 1/6G. The sequence of activity shown here is the restoring of all the thermal meteoroid garments and portable life support systems to suitable stowage locations so that the arrangements for sleep can be made. The harness which was used to hold the portable life support system in a donning configuration is hooked to provide the hammock configuration for sleeping. We would expect for the crew to sleep suited in the lunar module, since the bottled gas supply system has some limited capability in the event of a puncture, and since the somewhat thinner skin and location on the lunar surface have somewhat higher, though very low, probability of such an event. If there is a puncture, the system can hold pressure in the vehicle for a substantial time period. When the crew is ready to depart, there is a substantial amount of equipment left behind. The used lithium hydroxide canisters from the lunar module itself and from the portable life support systems, the batteries, bags containing the condensate and urine and other fecal materials are treated with germicidal agents and stowed in a compartment in the descent stage. These equipments are left behind in the interests of saving weight in the ascent stage, thereby enhancing to some degree the amount of material which can be returned for scientific purposes. Lunar ascent has been described in considerable detail by Mr. Jenkins. This slide on the right shows the configuration of the vehicle at this time. The portable life support system is stowed on the floor to ease access to the optical telescope, which would be used to align the IMU just prior to liftoff. The other PLSS previously stowed here has been discarded. The equipment is stowed in such a fashion as to maintain the CG as well as possible. Again, the crew activities are essentially those which we have reviewed earlier and associated with powered flight maneuvers. During the ascent portion of the mission, the crew will again experience a 1/3 G acceleration environment, which is quite acceptable for the standing configuration. The details of the rendezvous and docking sequence, as executed by the guidance system, have been discussed in detail earlier. It is perhaps well at this point to note that in addition to those activities, it is possible to use the pilotage routines based upon observation of the 8-ball and of the other vehicle, which have been used in Gemini. In this phase of the mission, the lunar module is the active element in the docking sequence. The pilot of the lunar module can observe through a window in this location, and he has a docking aid similar to the one shown earlier installed in this window of the command module. The sequence of this docking is shown in this film, wherein we can see the overhead window above the pilot's head. And while this is not a customary orientation of the crewman relative to his controls, it is an acceptable one, and we have demonstrated successfully that this is a suitable maneuver. It has the virtue, of course, that the fuel is used out of that vehicle which will be left behind at this particular point in the mission and conserves the fuel available in the command and service module. Here we can see the device which was not apparent in the earlier command module active docking, and we can again see the approach of the two vehicles. There is no docking mechanism, so there will not be actual physical contact, but the alignment and proximity of the vehicles is correctly established. When the two vehicles have been docked, we have a repetition of the sequence in which the docking mechanisms must be removed from the tunnel. And then we can transfer the equipment and the crew back to the command and service module. At this point in time, we leave a number of devices in the lunar module to relieve congestion in the command and service module and to enhance the arrangements for the stowage of significant items returned from the lunar surface. It is perhaps noteworthy that we retain one of the portable life support systems in the command module, its oxygen capability being used as a backup to the entry oxygen supply during that portion of the mission. The TV camera is returned to the command module, and the lunar module flight plan, which is now the log and record of that flight, are returned for record purposes. The sample return containers and the films from the sequence camera and other cameras are returned. The data storage electronic assembly is the voice recorder provided for crew usage in the lunar module. The devices transferred to the lunar module are those no longer required in future phases of the mission, and they are in effect left to get rid of them. It is possible that during the docking sequence there can be a failure of the mechanism which would not allow transfer through the tunnel. We have a device called the Extravehicular Crew Transfer Device, EVCT, which is a de Havilland boom reeled out to some 25 feet in length, which engages a device called the Baylor bar at the command and service module interface. Either the crewman in the command module can open the hatch, or the hatch can be opened after the vehicle is depressurized by the crewman on the outside of the command module. The procedures would call for transfer of one of the crewmen from the LEM using the portable life support system in this device, and he would then use this device to return the portable life support system, or having established the configuration of the command module, the second crewman could be brought across using this device as a tether and using the emergency oxygen supply to provide breathing gases. Trans-earth injection is very similar to the translunar injection maneuvers previously described. It has a somewhat higher acceleration than the maneuvers we've discussed earlier, the light weight of the system now giving us an effective 1/2 of a G. Trans-earth is again characterized by those activities which characterize the translunar leg of the mission. The phenomena of apparent growth in size will occur also on this leg. We have a film which has been prepared by our computation and data analysis people in a simulation on a cathode ray tube face, where a frame of film is provided every 4 seconds of real mission time. The line of sight illustrated in the film is always to the center of the Earth, but the trajectory is a proper Apollo return trajectory, and if one watches the upper edge of the Earth image, one can notice the regression which indicates that it is indeed a suitable reentry course. You can see the continents go by, indicating the passage of time. You can see the proper movement of the stars relative to the Earth as the mission returns. We started with an Earth occupying 2 degrees and will return to one which initially occupies 146 degrees. You can note the apparent reduction of the Earth towards the bottom. Again, the entry sequence has been described in some detail by Dr. Duncan, but it is perhaps important to note that a large number of the sequential events are controlled directly by the crew, and those not directly under their control in the nominal mode are subject to crew backup. I believe that concludes the time allotted, and we have successfully returned. Thank you.
Well, there you got the impact of having the man on the program. Are there any questions or comments before the coffee break? Oh, yeah, the unmanned program. All right.
Has consideration been
The question is whether the consideration has been given to opening the top hatch and looking around.
Yes, we have given some consideration to it. There is a problem in that we are now in a 1/6 G field, and we would have to manipulate the docking drogue, which is installed in the top section of the limb. This is rather difficult. Secondly, we would have to do this during a time period when the vehicle would be evacuated, since the hatch would be open. This would require a rather long oxygen umbilical with the associated pressure drops, which are prejudicial to good design. It also appears that we do not get an appreciably better view from on top than we have from the front porch kind of an effect. It would theoretically be possible to do a 360-degree sweep, but the difficulties and the time required to do that did not seem to be worth the small additional increase. Approximately 220 degrees.
You can't see the enemy sneaking up from dead astern, but aside from that, it's all right. Yes.
I have four questions, if I go through them.
Go through them real quick, and then we'll take the coffee break.
How much direct view can the crew see of the Earth and the Moon, and how the wind is there leaving the Earth and going towards the Moon? You showed the growth rate in there, but
the question was, how much can the crew see of the Earth and the Moon during the translunar and trans-Earth legs? It depends a great deal the degree to which we have processed in the passive thermal control maneuvers and the relative orientation of the bodies at various points along the trajectory. But there is a considerable opportunity to view, since there are four windows, and the side windows of the command module are rather large, and at this time we are not restricted to a design eye position. So the crew can move to an orientation which at least a substantial portion of the time will allow a view.
They're not blocked by the limb.
The side windows are not blocked by the limb, and there is some small view around the lunar module from the rendezvous and docking windows. No, we do not understand what the effect of crew movement within the vehicle will do as a perturbing force. We would expect it to be reasonably small, since they have no reason to bounce off the walls. Well,
I noticed that what Paul had mentioned, that they were taking the garments off without their pressure gloves.
I don't think that we would be too directly concerned in some senses. We have made some provisions for removing lunar material adhering to the exterior of the thermal meteorite garments. We could, if it were necessary, perform those operations gloved. There are provisions, and obviously the particular details of the mission and weight allowances, volumes, would govern for any of several types of cameras. In the initial types of missions, we plan 35-millimeter stereopticon cameras. We have 70-millimeter camera capability. We have a 16-millimeter motion picture camera capability. We do not directly contemplate redundancy. since these devices have all been tested to rather rigorous standards.
Any more questions? I see one in the back over there.
During the landing and the takeoff, is the co-pilot completely occupied with the task, or is he essentially monitoring the co-pilot?
I think that the relationship among the two crew members in the lunar module is essentially that of a team. One gains relatively little from independent type of operation. There are such things, for example, as the fact that the two flight director attitude indicators can be referenced to the two different systems, the primary and the abort guidance system. One would normally expect the pilot to use the primary system and the co-pilot to use the abort guidance system as a reference, but the objective of having the two displays and the two men would be to enhance reliability and safety by using the two concurrent in time. So I think it's best to say that it is essentially a team operation, and it is not one man doing and one man watching.
Anybody else? Len?
Two questions. Did I understand correctly that you are at least tentatively allowing some slack in the timeline for in-flight scientific
instruction?
There was a comment made to that effect. What he said was that some 40% of the time is not allocated, and considering the inevitability of experiments in the same category as death and taxes, he presumed that there might be some included.
The question pertains to the sterilization of fecal containers and used food containers. There are germicidal agents provided as part of each of these assemblies in order to provide for sterilization when they are left in any one of the several places. The presumed life of the lunar module in orbit when left has been estimated as...
Anybody else? Bill Green.
You couldn't say much about the solo CSM period, critical activities there.
The question pertains to solo activities in the command module. Yes, the activities by the crewman alone in the command module are reasonably demanding. He has the advantage, however, that he, for the most part, can pre-plan these maneuvers, as is characteristic of the nominal mission. And the vehicle has been designed with this condition in mind. As a consequence, some controls are provided at two different locations in the vehicle so that in this mode the crewman will not be subjected to unnecessary requirements for movement. In the event of command module having to perform a rescue of the lunar module, this would be a very demanding activity, and one of the objectives of our early development flights is to come to appreciate the procedures required to accomplish that.
Werner, you had a question, did you?
You mentioned a potential problem of degrading the thermal coating of the limb with by the RCS jets of the service module during that docking and transit maneuver subsequent to translunar injection. How serious is that problem in your opinion? You said that by blasting these jets short pulses, it could be alleviated somewhat.
The question pertained to the effect on the lunar module thermal coatings of the RCS engines during the lunar module extraction from the adapter. There will be a discussion later of the thermal problems where some of these details will be discussed. I think the reason for the short duty cycles in this particular maneuver is that we do not normally have prolonged thrusting in these engines since they're primarily attitude controlled and our ullage maneuvers are in the opposite direction. And since we presume that any degradation is prejudicial to the system, and since it costs us nothing in convenience to treat it gently, we would just plan to do so.
Okay, I think we'll now break for coffee. There will then be two more papers, and the first of the papers, in order to get you back from the coffee break in a reasonable period of time, you've been rather slow coming back, as I think you recognize. You're now digging into your lunch hour, into your leaving time, and as an extra added attraction, the next paper will have models, live models, prancing across the stage.